The CIA Black Ops program put these Tibetans where it made most sense, Crestone. Tibet was mostly arid. Crestone was in an arid part of Colorado. Tibet was very high. Crestone was in a high part of Colorado. There were nearby mountains that were even higher. Best of all, Crestone was so far away from anything that nobody in 1958 was going to look there. Pretty much the same arguments as why they set up Oak Ridge in Appalachia. So they took 200 Tibetan fighters and some of their families out of refugee camps in India and Nepal and brought them to Crestone, Colorado to start training to retake their homeland. Victory was assured. Enter the Dalai Lama, who got wind of the program. The Dalai Lama was an absolute Buddhist pacifist, and there's no group more pacifist than Buddhist pacifists. He also had been basically the king of Tibet and was, like the Japanese emperor, the highest moral authority. He put his sandaled foot down and forbade any of them from engaging in combat. To do so would damn them for eternity upon the wheel. So much for the armed Free Tibet program. And note to people who think my mother's approach is right, the non-violent approach of Gandhi and Martin Luther King requires a government that is in some way Western, moral, and beholden to the will of the people. Fascist and communist dictatorships don't give a shit. Anything but an armed Free Tibet program is flapping your gums to no avail. And international relations pro tip. So the Tibetans were told not to talk to anyone about the original plan, each given a small severance package and residency papers, and the CIA walked away. That left about 500 Tibetans in the middle of bumfuck nowhere. Not to mention a bunch of CIA case officers who had to find a new career specialty. Fortunately, the Vietnam War was just heating up. All the mines were closed and there were about no jobs. Paradise, the land of opportunity. To Tibetans, Crestone looked like nirvana. There was so much water. Remember the thing about the sand dunes? There were electric lights. You didn't have to go collect sticks over miles of parched terrain to cook dinner and hold off the biting cold of a Tibetan summer. To make a long story short, they settled in. They started businesses which covered the whole no jobs thing. They got irrigation credits and started farms. They walked the hills and found overlooked mineral deposits, found out who the local babu was that had to be paid off, and started small mines. Mining in Tibet had been even more tightly controlled than in the U.S., and almost as corrupt. They dug in and worked, and not a few of them became rich. The United States is a nation of immigrants. We need more like the Tibetans. Some of them had eventually moved away. There was a large Tibetan population in Seattle, for example. That was where I hooked up with them. The occasional times that I'd needed a charm in Seattle, I'd used either Chinese or Tibetans. It always boggled them that around I could speak their language and, in many cases, read the ancient tongues better than they could. But the CIA hadn't only brought fighters, they'd also brought shamans, because if you're going to move a group as tied into the supernatural as the Tibetans, that's what you do. They won't move without having a lama or a shaman tell them which way is the correct way to place their foot. Because, let me make this clear, Tibet really is rife with hoodoo. Go up the wrong valley in Tibet, and you're going to get your soul sucked out and your bones spit on the ground. Some of those shamans were still around. Older now, creakier, more powerful, and a few of them very knowledgeable. When the shamans in Seattle had a question they couldn't answer, they'd take a pilgrimage to Crestone. And when it was really tough, they'd talk to Father Pema. Pema meant lotus, but it wasn't considered by the Tibetans to be a girly name. The lotus has a special meaning in Buddhism, and Father Lotus was the most powerful and knowledgeable Tibetan shaman in the New World. Crestone still looked like an old West mining town. Many of the downtown buildings were from the original boom period in the late 1800s. Single-story, clapboard siding, covered porches, elevated to get away from the mud when it rarely rained. There were some newer houses, a few brick, mostly cheap vinyl siding and single-story. Cars were up on blocks in many yards, and there were a few vegetable gardens here and there. Only the main drags, Colorado 71 and Country Road 510, were paved. Father Pema's house was on Alder Street near North Crestone Creek. The house was old, clabbered, but was well cared for. Freshly painted with a straggling front lawn and a garden on the side that I suspected ran mostly to medicinal and magical herbs. Hopefully all of them were legal, but some of Tibetan medicine used hemp extracts. I suspected those plants were somewhere up in the mountains, probably tended to by apprentices. And some Tibetan medicinal plants were more powerful than peyote, if not on the controlled substances list. Father Pema was tricky. Sometimes he'd talk to a round eye, and sometimes not. Hell, sometimes he'd blow off other shamans. And he didn't have a phone. If you wanted to talk to him, you had to come see him. Calling ahead wasn't preferred. You presented yourself at his house, and he'd get to you at his convenience. But if he had a weakness, it was the same as Madame Courtney's. And I had 2 bottles of a locally made New Orleans dark spiced rum with me. It was late spring by then, but there were still patches of snow in sheltered areas, and coming from New Orleans, it was cold as shit. I'd rented a car at the nearest airport. The heater didn't work. I was freezing my ass off. It felt wonderful. I walked up on Father Pema's porch and knocked on the door. It was answered by a young male Tibetan who looked like one of the round-eyes-all-need-to-be-buried types. "I'm looking for Father Pema," I said in Tibetan. I held out the bottles, still in a brown paper bag. "I bring gifts." "Father Pema does not talk to barbarians," the kid said haughtily. "He has spoken to me before. It regards certain writings of a lama from the 1st century. I put this in correct Tibetan phraseology, which was more or less the words of a grand master of the eternal wheel from the time of the king of the 18th lotus petal lying on the waters of the Buddha. Which clearly confused the hell out of Pema's new apprentice. "The what?" he said in English. "I've got some Tibetan writing from the 1st century A.D. I need his interpretation." I switched to English and tapped the satchel on my hip. "I also need him to figure out what material I need to destroy a major mava. And by major, I mean the largest ever found in North America. Unknown to Father Lotus. Tell him it's Tiewan." "I'll see if he's in." The kid took the bottles. He still looked puzzled. I took a seat on one of the rockers on the porch and settled down to wait. It might be a few seconds. It might be days. That was the way Father Pema worked. As it was about 2 hours when the door opened and Father Pema walked out. He was ancient. Exact ages, like real names, are something the Tibetans don't talk about. The birth date of a child has magic significance, so they're cagey about their birthdays. But he had to be around 90. He was short. I'd never seen a tall Tibetan. Wiry, very muscular legs, and a grip like an industrial press.
"Iron Hand, what problems do you bring an old man this time?"
"We suspect there's a mava in New Orleans," I said in Tibetan, pulling out my notes from Oxford. "A great beast of the deep with many parts that extend long distances. The notes I have called it a mother of worms."
"There is a mother of worms in this land,"
Pema exclaimed. Tibetans don't show fear or surprise. He was afraid and surprised. "So we suspect. I have the writings of the Lama which defeated one to the north of Tibet in the 1st century.
"Where did you find the writings of the most perfect Lama Tubten?"
Pema said eagerly. "They are not the writings of the Lama. They are words of one of his surviving apprentices. I found them in the library at Oxford. These are only notes.
I would see even the notes of such.
He held out his hand. I sat down as the old shaman read through my notes. They were in Tibetan, or at least my version of it. Some of the notes were exact copying of the manuscripts. You couldn't photocopy something that old and fragile.
I would love to see the original,
Father Pema said when he was done reading. It was after dark, and the cold was starting to get to me. I was wearing a sweater and coat. Father Pema was in shorts and a short-sleeved shirt. I wasn't going to complain. I'll gladly pay your way to visit Oxford. The scholars there would love to have someone of your knowledge visit.
That would involve traveling by aeroplane and ship, yes? I've done that before. I did not like it.
Airplanes have gotten much better since the 1950s.
I don't even like cars. I like my feet on the ground. What would you know?
What are the unguents and materials used by the most perfect Tubten to defeat the Great Worm Mother?
This is knowledge known only to the most perfect.
Pema handed the notes back.
I am barely a scraper of the ground compared to the most perfect lamas.
A most perfect lama was the Tibetan equivalent of a cardinal. There were probably 5 left on Earth, and none of those would give me the time of day.
Also, Pema said, much of this knowledge was lost in the Great Corruption.
That was what they called the Chinese invasion.
I doubt that a most perfect lama would give such information to you, and I suspect that none know these arts in this time. They are lost forever.
Were any of them ever written? Perhaps in tomes of medicine or healing? Would I be able to find any hint in such?
If there is a library that has this, such a library may have the original recipes. But,
he took a deep breath,
the mystic unguents of the most perfect would have been merely a carrier for the power of the Great Lotus. You simply need the power of strong healing and that which fights the corruption of the earth. It is any material which represents the blessed faith of the good. It need not be Tibetan.
That sounds like...
I hate to say this,
Pema said, getting up.
But you can probably drown it in a few 1,000 gallons of holy water. Best if it's blessed by a truly devoted priest, but that's much easier to get your hands on. Anything else?
No. That's it. He walked into the house without saying goodbye. I got back in my rattletrap rental and headed back to the airport. Maybe the heat in the flea bag motel would be working. It wasn't. Pueblo was in a region equally as arid as Crestone, but was a typical modern American town. This time I'd called ahead, admittedly just from the airport, and there was, thank God, an Avis outlet, so I had a decent car. The door to the 2-story home was opened by a teenage girl. I barely recognized her. The last time I'd seen her, she'd been 2 years younger, filthy, covered in sores, and terrified. Also, strapped to an altar in the middle of a firefight.
Chad,
she shouted, throwing her arms around me.
It's so good to see you.
That was also very loud. Mandy Cummings would speak very loudly for the rest of her life. That was my fault. And Milo's. Explosions wreck your hearing. She also had fine scars on the right side of her face and some sight loss in the right eye. It was all collateral damage, but we had managed to save her life. I hugged back. She'd gotten much more squeezable. You've grown.
I have you guys to thank for it.
Mandy grinned. Her family was gathered in the hallway watching this with amusement. I wasn't sure what they'd been told about Mandy's rescue, and I'd have to deal with that carefully. Before MCB Seattle even got to the scene, we'd told the girls they couldn't talk about what actually happened to them. The doctors Nelson were psychologists by original trade, and had helped the girls as best they could. Mandy seemed to have mostly recovered from the ordeal. I'm Chad Gardenier. I held my hand out to her father.
We were sort of surprised when you called. Arthur Cummings was 40s, balding, but solid. From what I remembered, he worked in construction. The rescuees had been from all over the western United States, so we hadn't ended up meeting any of the families. Some of the girls held in the container were from the Pueblo area. Others who had been captured in the area had been separated out, either not virgins or sold elsewhere, and that was why I was there. Mandy had been at a girls' night with friends when the ring had attacked the house. The ring had killed the rest of the family and taken all the girls. Two had been rescued by MHI, in Mandy's case by the thinnest of margins. My information on the cover story was that it was a Satan-worshipping serial killer ring, which was close to the truth.
You're one of the men who rescued Mandy, the mother said.
Clara Cummings was short, plump, and blonde. Nice enough looking for being in her 40s.
Yes, ma'am.
Where are my manners?
She gestured toward the living room.
Please come in.
You're FBI?
Mr. Cummings said when we were situated. Mrs. Cummings had gone to get snacks.
No, sir. My company is hired to handle certain types of cases by the government.
I waved at the various scars on my face.
The types of cases where people end up like this. Sort of bounty hunters. Other than that, it's classified.
Okay. Mandy's told us how she wasn't supposed to talk about certain things, but damn it, people have a right to know.
I agree, sir. And I disagree. Why, in both cases, is not only highly classified, it would take hours and hours to explain. And some of it, frankly, you probably wouldn't believe. So I'll leave it at that. Bottom line, I helped save your daughter's life, but now I really need your help.
You can pretty much ask for anything, he said, hugging Mandy to him. You on the run?
No, I said, not adding, but it's getting close. It's about the people who took Mandy. I need to talk to the parents of girls who didn't get them back.
They hardly talk to us,
Mandy said unhappily and loudly.
They wanted to know what happened, and I couldn't really talk about it. The Hamiltons was where they took us. They're all gone. The Morrisons and the Hawkins divorced. We really only ever see the Simpsons because we still go to the same church. I have a hard time looking Mr. and Mrs. Simpson in the eye. We used to be friends.
Grief changes things. But I really need to talk to as many of the families as I can. I need something from them as well. But I'll talk to them.
We can tell you where they live, Mr. Cummings said, shrugging. Give you some numbers. But like Mandy said, they don't really talk to us anymore.
That'll be fine. They might not talk to the Cummings anymore, but say it's about your missing daughter, and grieving parents will tell you anything. The Simpsons' house was practically identical to the Cummings. U.S. suburb, one each. It was also right around the corner. Irene and Warren Simpson had 4 children. Their middle daughter, Marcella, had gone over to a friend's one night and never returned. The Hamilton house had been burned to the ground. At first they thought their daughter had died in a fire. Then came the word that none of the bodies of the girls had been found. Then it was suspected one of the girls had started the fire. Then the FBI showed up, and they found out it matched a string of disappearances. They'd called their local police department for information. They'd called the FBI. They'd put up flyers. They'd gone on local television. But their daughter had disappeared into the night. They were willing to talk to anyone who might give them some closure. They just wanted to know if she was alive or dead. Anything.
I knew there would never be closure. Their daughter was positively identified as having been sacrificed by the Seattle Lich. And the way the Lich got rid of the bodies was to feed them, bones and all, to his pet ghouls. There wasn't so much as a scrap of hair left of their daughter. Since MCB wasn't about to let that out, parents would die waiting for word of their daughter's fate. Frankly, I wasn't going to tell them that. Even if it wouldn't put me in more trouble with the MCB, I wasn't going to look them in the eye and say, "Your daughter's soul was torn out with her heart and used to power an undead being, one that is still on the loose, so until it's killed, her soul is trapped between worlds, and her body was eaten by ghouls. Sorry." Yeah, wasn't going there. "I was one of the people who rescued Mandy Cummings," was what I said to the two parents. "My company is also involved in looking for news of other victims, including your daughter Marcella."
"Is there anything you can tell us?"
Mr. Simpson asked, holding his wife's hand. "Not really. You got word that this was a ring, right?"
"Yes,"
Mrs. Simpson said.
"Satan worshippers. How in God's name can something like that go on in this day and age?"
"Not in God's name, ma'am. That I can tell you for sure. I won't tell you that we're going to get your daughter back, like we did Mandy. I tell you that as sort of an expert in this area. She's almost certainly gone. You understand that?"
"Yes."
Mrs. Simpson teared up. There was a box of Kleenex on the table, and I pulled one out and handed it to her. They were used to these sorts of conversations, and prepared. "There is a new scientific way to identify remains," I said carefully. "I don't know if you know this, but bodies are found all over the U.S. all the time. What we're trying to do is sort out some of those unidentified remains. Jane Doe's, ones that match the general description of your daughter and other potential victims."
"Why are they unidentifiable?"
her sister Robin asked. "I'd really rather not get into that. Just, when some hunters find a body in the woods that's been there for a while, sometimes they don't even realize it's a human body."
"Oh."
Robin got pale.
"Wasn't there any word on Marcella when you found Mandy and Risa?"
Mr. Simpson asked. "Not that I can get into. This is an ongoing investigation. I know you want some information, anything. But if the people who took your daughter, who are continuing to take other people's daughters, get word of details of the investigation, can make them change their patterns, making it harder to find them. And it's hard enough as it is. Also, if any information leaks out from the investigation, it can compromise the trial. I'm pretty sure you don't want your daughter's kidnappers released on a technicality. That's why the FBI is so close to the vest with information, and I have to be as well. What I need, though, is fairly simple. I just need a few hairs."
"Hairs?"
Mrs. Simpson demanded.
"You're not one of those damn psychics, are you?"
"No," I said, not adding, "but I know a few. The reason is the identification method. You've heard of DNA? It's found in every living cell. It's what's passed down from you to your children, and it's as unique as a fingerprint for an individual. We'll take the hairs and run what's called a DNA profile, then compare it to potential remains that might be Marcella. At the very least, it may give you some closure if we can find her body."
"I guess that makes sense," Mr. Simpson said.
"Do you have her hairbrush? One that only she used?"
"We do,"
Mrs. Simpson said, tearing up again. I handed her more tissues. I'd wanted to kill these assholes before. But now, this was feeling really personal. Dealing with all the families was painful. It was one of the reasons I never could have been a cop. I preferred killing monsters to handing over tissues. It wasn't that I was bad at detective work. Being a detective was about figuring out patterns, and I was really good at pattern recognition. But crying families was not my thing. I also had to track down the Morrisons and then the Hawkins. The mothers had kept mementos of their daughters. In both cases, the girls were their only children, and between the grief, the silences, the wondering, the couples had divorced. It turned out all the families had kept keepsakes. I had 4 hair samples from the victims for Madame Courtney to use. I was glad as hell to head back to New Orleans, heat and all. I was ready to kill me some monsters. Preferably the monsters who were taking these girls. But anything would do. Chapter 8. I really should get back to monster killing, but this is a memoir about the job. And part of the job, when you get past dumb grunt me monster killer, is finding out about the monsters, tracking them down, figuring out how to kill them. So, you're gonna have to bear with me. When I got back to New Orleans, nothing much had changed. MCB was still riding our asses. We'd gotten in a replacement for Evans, and with the loup-garou infestation under control, New Orleans was only mildly impossible to manage. My first week back, besides the meeting with Madame Courtney and trying to track the Mava Panavae, we had some calls, but it was all the usual shit. Nothing terribly interesting. Milo was a bombin' pig-stuffing, kifo-killing machine. He'd baited every single eruption site and gotten another hit. There hadn't been any more new attacks since we'd gone on the offensive. So the second day I was back, I took the hair samples to Madame Courtney's residence. Despite the fact that I knew the door was probably unlocked, you don't barge into a hoodoo woman's house, so I waited for her to let me in. Strangely enough, her house wasn't nearly as decorated with charms and trinkets as her office, so a lot of those were probably just for show. "Dem de girls?" she asked, as I pulled out the baggies with hair samples. "Pro tip, carry rubber gloves and Ziploc bags with you at all times. There are things you don't want to touch with your hands, and you have to take tissue samples for confirmation of kill. In this case, I had 4 plastic baggies with the names written on them. Tracy Morrison, Megan Hawkins, Marcella Simpson, and Sherry Harvey. 2 blondes, a strawberry blonde, and a bottle blonde with brown roots. Those and memories were about all that remained of those 4 girls. Morrison, Hawkins, and Simpson were all positively identified as being sacrificed. Harvey had been separated off from the other girls and presumably sold to some other bastard who wanted a virgin sacrifice. "Yes, ma'am," I handed over the baggies. We'd moved to the small kitchen table in the room for this, and she pulled out each one carefully and laid them out on a white cloth. Then she closed her eyes and appeared to go to sleep with her hands held out over the hairs. She stayed like that, head down for a bit, then her eyes flashed open.
"This one is alive," she said,
holding up the strands of bottle blonde hair from Sherry Harvey.
"The laws can't find her. She's warded, but she still lives. The rest is gone. 2 is in heaven. 1, this one," she said, holding up Marcella Simpson's hairs. "Her soul be held in a vessel of the unclean. But this one be alive here to earth."
"That's odd. Given what this ring does, I'd have thought she'd be heart-ripped by now."
"Delores say she wasn't totally without sin."
Madame Courtney ran the hairs through her hands, eyes closed.
"She was a wild one, this one. Hard life. Sad. But still alive. Worse now. She's gone evil, this one."
"Joined the group?"
"Can't rightly tell. But she gone to the black, can't tell that. The Loas see a darkness clinging to her. Now to try and figure out why the G-Man thinks you have something to do with it."
She started by casting the bones,
looking for more information on the girls or those who had held them. On the ones who were dead, there was little information. But when she cast upon Sherry Harvey, the one still alive, she got more and asked for one of my hairs. I was shaved bald, so I had to clip a fingernail. Then she cast them together, holding the strands of hair and a fingernail in her hands, eyes closed.
"It is true," she said in a deep voice, eyes now open and unseeing. "You are the Alpha and Omega of this taking. You were the one who started this, and you shall be the one to finish it."
"Madam Courtney, that makes no sense."
"You are bound to your brother, Cain and Abel, Yin and Yang. You brought this to the world through that binding. You are the source of this taking. You shall be its end."
Her eyes closed, and she shuddered and lay back in the wooden chair, exhausted.
"Are you okay?"
"I'm fine. The White Loas are angry. Fearsome anger, but not at you. You may have somehow caused this, but not maliciously. You are not the true culprit. That I'm sure of now. The Loas are not mad at you, but they're angry as hell at your brother, though."
I didn't know how it made me feel to have it confirmed that Thornton was behind this. Certainly not surprised.
"He is an instrument of evil as sure as you were chosen for good."
Madam Courtney paused to take a big gulp of rum.
"You're the beginning and end, but he's the whole middle. These sins are his doing. Delores was clear on that."
Then I get the Cain and Abel reference, because the minute I find him, I'm going to go full on Cain.
"That would appear to be your calling."
My real estate lady heartily agreed with my murder plans. "Can you find him?"
"Doubt it. Even with a hair or such. Sure, he's warded as well. What I might be able to find is this one," she added, picking up Marcella Simpson's hair. "This one is the power for an unclean vessel. I can feel the vessel. Ain't far off. Not New Orleans near. But it moves."
"Moves?"
"I can feel it moving now," she said, her voice deepening again. "Traveling, feeding, defiling. The monstrous vessel is warded. The soul, though. The soul of the innocent cries out for release. For heaven. For peace. It is tormented within that vessel. It longs for heaven, for a rescuer. This soul I can find, Mr. Gardenier. This soul you can find."
She opened her eyes and shook herself again.
"Dem Loas be all over this. Angry Loas. I can see dem warrior Loas. They be shaking out their wings, shaking off the dust of centuries, ready to fly, they so angry. Find these, and you may have no job to do. The Loas will rip their black hearts out with fiery hands. Come back in 3 days. I'll have something you can track this soul down with."
The sooner the better to track down my stupid brother. But I could make use of those days. Good. I have to see a woman about a horse. This time I wasn't meeting in an out-of-the-way house. This time I strode through the halls of power unafraid. This time I was meeting power players right in the open. Because this time in D.C., I was going to bring a smack down to MCB. Convincing Garrett to arrange the meeting with the senior member of the Republican side of the aisle, a senator from Oklahoma, as well as the chairwoman, a Democrat congresswoman from California, had been tough. My point was that it was do or die. Trying to duck and cover on slander like this only worked so long.
We're nearly late, Bert said, looking at his watch.
Nearly is not the same as late, I said. I have no intention of turning up 40 minutes early.
You'd better have something concrete, the congressman's aide said.
MCB doesn't have anything concrete. I'm going to give the committee the same thing the MCB's been peddling, but with the details left in. And a week from now, I'm going to hammer it home with a stake.
Honorable Chairwoman, I said, shaking her hand.
I cordially detested Congresswoman Jeanette O'Brien, Democrat, California, and the same could be said in reverse. She was a huge proponent of my mother's side of the argument, give monsters a chance. Mostly, I was sure, because of round-robin funding. Give the monster advocates grants, and they sent money back to fund the Congresswoman's campaigns. Then there was the fact that, like most members of the Select Committee on Unearthly Forces, she had never personally dealt with the aftermath of a group of vampires. When I'd started doing the same round-robin with puff money, it had upset the apple cart. But since my funding had been cross-aisle, not one dime of monster lover grant money ever went to Republicans, she had to give at least lip service to paying attention lest she lose support from the Democrat side. That was the only reason she was giving me the time of day. I had been allotted 10 minutes in front of the Select Committee to make my case.
Mr. Gardenier, she said, shaking my hand, then taking a seat behind her big desk, along with the rest of the politicians.
You begged for this meeting. Make it quick.
As I'm sure you all know, I've recently been slandered by the MCB. I would like to point out that slander is their stock in trade. Often necessarily, but anyone associated with this committee should recognize that when someone uses slander on a daily basis for their job, using it for politics becomes second nature.
Uh-huh. And you expect me to believe the MCB has been feeding us maliciously motivated lies?
Far from it. It's incompetence, which, given that our country depends on the MCB for protection from the most heinous of all enemies, is far, far worse. It was slander based upon incompetence and for purely political ends.
You've lost me. Senator Vaughn was one of the slower committee members.
Which was it?
Both. I did the same thing MCB did. I went to a spellcaster and had a reading done on the location and status of some of the victims. I obtained hair samples from some of the victims' families and took them to a very powerful white voodoo woman in New Orleans. She confirmed most of what the MCB said.
Then MCB's investigation could hardly be called slander, the chairwoman said. The only reason you haven't been arrested is that Gary stuck his neck out for you. He's rapidly run out of favors. This meeting is his last one.
Garrett Terry didn't look very happy when she put that out there so brazenly. I said most. The Alpha and Omega part, yes. But that basic information, Madam Chairwoman, is useless without good analysis, which MCB screwed up entirely. I'm sure they got a very strong reading that I was involved, but that is because spirits were practically screaming that I needed to be involved in the case. I'm the one who was supposed to end it. Get me involved. Make me a part of it. She actually laughed out loud.
When hell freezes over. So you're saying you're not involved in the ring? Another congressman asked.
Do you seriously think I've got time to kidnap children? I snapped. No, I am not. But what the casting actually meant was that to stop the ring, I had to become involved in the investigation. I am the Omega, he who shall end it, the only one who can end it for whatever reason.
How? Senator Vaughn asked.
I'll do what MCB should have done 2 years ago. I'll track the souls of the victims, because I am not incompetent.
You strolled in here thinking that we're just going to take you at your word just because some two-bit New Orleans parlor witch you dredged up contradicts the report provided by the multi-billion-dollar federal agency. The chairwoman snorted. That's pretty incompetent. Give me a week, and I'll find and shut this kidnapping ring down myself. I'll do in 2 weeks what the MCB hasn't been able to do in 2 years. I sure hoped I wouldn't come to regret that promise.
Chad, I should probably point out that if you do so, the MCB will simply say that you were involved all along and are now just covering your tracks, Congressman Terry said.
I'm sure they will. Which illustrates the real problem here. Anything can be considered being involved, actual intent and actions be damned. Madam Chairwoman, all the illustrious members of the committee, are you aware that you are fundamentally in the same position as Congressman Terry? Excuse me? She asked. You take money from people who are involved in necromancy. You have close supporters who are potentially puff-applicable.
How dare you say that?
The Congresswoman shouted.
Because it is true? So does Congressman Bouvrier, Senator Cochin, Senator Vaughn. I can continue listing members of the committee, Republican and Democrat. And each and every one of you daily have interaction with those who work with the supernatural just from MCB agents alone. They, in turn, have contact with necromancers. A casting about any one of you, even those who consider themselves sacrosanct, would probably turn up similar connections.
It certainly isn't on purpose, but I can guarantee that all of us have gotten donations from some slimy individuals, Congressman Terry said. There was some muttering, nodding, and shrugs. Most of the committee didn't care about me one way or the other, but they didn't like the idea that MCB could hit them with the same hammer.
All and equally. Which brings up the real problem. MCB used a poorly done, badly analyzed casting to attack a member of your committee. Congressman Terry has done no wrong, except associate with a falsely accused man. As MCB can do at any time they choose to any one of you they want.
The MCB wouldn't do that to one of us, insisted Vaughn.
They just did. Are you going to allow MCB to jerk your leash? The way it's set up, isn't the leash supposed to be on them? Are you willing to relinquish that power and let MCB decide, through slander and lies, which are their stock in trade, who is and who is not to be on your committee? Because the second you let MCB have that power, they will take it from you and never give it back.
Boy has a point, Senator Bouvrier said thoughtfully.
That is a very serious accusation, a congresswoman snapped.
I'm not making an accusation. I'm making an observation. I don't care. This is politics. You choose your bedfellows. The congressmen and senators choose theirs. That's how it works. MCB should not be deciding who is and is not acceptable on this committee based on that. If they made it on the basis of who has the worst contacts, many of your supporters couldn't pass that test, nor could you. So are you going to let them decide through whisper campaigns?
About half the committee seemed thoughtful about the idea of an out-of-control MCB. The other half wanted me to get cancer and die. That was a better ratio than I'd hoped for.
Your time is up, the chairwoman said. We'll look into this.
Please do, I said, standing up. In the meantime, I have a case to solve. I picked up the soul tracker from Madam Courtney after getting back from D.C. Now I just had to make good on my promise to track them down. For which I would need help.
You want to take somebody else? Franklin said.
New Orleans seemed to be heating up again. The full moon was on the way, and we didn't need more people missing, but this was something that had to be done now.
I kind of told the select committee that I'd have the case solved by the end of the week. Franklin groaned. Which means tracking down and terminating a kidnapping ring that uses at least two whites that we know of. Can I take two whites? Sure. Can I take two whites, some armed humans, and probably some other undead at the same time? Not so sure. I need backup.
Franklin groaned again, louder this time. This was why I didn't ever want to be a team lead.
Damn it, Chad. Come on, Franklin. Just one good guy.
Got a new guy arriving today, Franklin sighed. Fresh out of training. I need him here, but maybe this will give him some more experience before the full moon.
I know beggars can't be choosers, but a newbie? I don't have time to babysit a newbie. I promised Congress.
He's good, or should be. Former SEAL chief.
Great, I said, grimacing. A fucking squid. What's his name?
Sam Haven.
Chapter 9.
Of course I got a fucking cowboy. Don't get me wrong. Sam Haven turned out to be a great guy, but it took a while for us to click. I'm sort of an intellectual, though I can play the dumb game. I like the finer things in life. I'm seriously into martial arts and Bushido. Sam was then and is now all about being the rangy tough guy. Born in Montana, raised on rodeo and pitching hay bales. If you'd tried to tell me that in a couple of years he would be considered one of the best hunters in the company, I wouldn't have believed you. I felt like Franklin had stuck me with some tobacco-spitting, cowboy hat and boots-wearing ex-squid who clearly thought his shit don't stink.
So let me get this straight, Sam drawled, spitting into his disgusting cup. It was a coffee mug with his SEAL team logo on it. Some group has been abducting girls for the last few years and killing their families, and the FBI and MCB can't solve shit. But we've got only a few days to track the kidnapping cocksuckers down using bullshit hocus-pocus.
We were driving up I-10 towards 49. The tracker, a simple crystal pendant with Marcella Simpson's hair wrapped around it, was swinging in a generally northwesterly direction. I just hooked it to my rearview mirror and off we went.
It's not hocus-pocus, it's hoodoo, I said. Magic. It'll work.
You say so, pal.
Sam's SEAL team had been on a training mission when a nearby cruise liner had been attacked. They'd inserted by helicopter, only to discover that the ship had been swarmed by deep ones, monsters which were a save-the-last-bullet-for-yourself type. Especially when they were breeding, which they were in this case. Sam's team had mostly been wiped out. Only two of the SEALs had survived. The lieutenant, by hiding in a locker. Sam, by running around killing everything that wasn't human. Total hero stuff, from what Franklin had told me. Problem being, MCB, when they'd arrived, had just gone and killed everyone who was implanted and anyone who might be implanted. Was it overkill? Wasn't there. Keeping deep ones down was a major concern. Probably something less drastic they could have done, but MCB tends to work on scorched earth. Often it's all they have time to do. Sam had complained about the murdered civilians, loudly and as officially as he was allowed, which meant MCB had to take care of the problem child. My guess was SEAL High Command went all weenie when they offered to off him. Instead, Sam's career was trashed and the coward lieutenant was suddenly a hero. Sam quit in disgust. The lieutenant, unsurprisingly, joined MCB. He'd fit right in. Probably make director someday. Or maybe not. I'd met good MCB agents. I missed Higgins and Castro nearly as much as I missed Trevor and Shelby. But I wasn't going to poke that bull with Haven. And a good bit of the question would be based on who was on the committee and whether the chairwoman would allow it to be gelded or not.
Magic crystals. What kind of chicken shit mission have I signed up for? Sam muttered as he looked at the charm. If it's so easy, how come the MCB never hired a magician to build them one of these?
MCB's got magic, I said. What they don't have is Madame Courtney.
Who's Madame Courtney?
One powerful as shit voodoo woman. White voodoo. If you're going to be working in New Orleans, you really should get to know her. She's also one hell of a real estate lady. You should see the house she found for me. But I don't think the Loas, think of them as angels, would show just anybody the way. I'm supposed to be the one who ends this, I said, nodding at the hair. One of the cult's undead is powered by the soul of that girl. Where it is, there will be its master.
Uh-huh.
Marcella's soul is sort of bound in a tiny slice of hell, and she's screaming to be rescued. Like I said, powerful as shit, white voodoo. Madame Courtney says the Loas are all over this and angry. That magic crystal you're sneering at represents a little girl who was murdered to power a strong undead, who is screaming for us to come kill it and let her poor tortured soul go to heaven. It'll work, because angels want me to find her.
This job is fucking weird.
You think this is weird? You might want to find another profession.
Nah, I'm good. Let's go rescue some damsels from the nefarious assholes of evil.
Don't get too wrapped up on that one. Most of the girls we save, they're so mentally messed up you don't want to get involved. On the other hand, Hoodoo Squad is pretty popular in New Orleans. Finding girls is not an issue.
That wasn't the direction I was thinking. But I've heard New Orleans knows how to party. The girls nice here?
Who wants nice girls? Nothing better than a slutty elf chick.
Elf? Now you're just fucking with me.
You've got to be shitting me, Sam said, laughing.
I'd suggest you check the scars on my ass, but I don't let swabbies that near my butt, I said.
Oh, you did not go there, Jarhead.
That story is totally made up, I said, shaking my head. A Bindarota. There is no way that is true. Bangkok, maybe. Not Rhoda.
God is my witness.
Sam held up one hand and put the other over his heart.
And you're one to talk. Next thing, you're going to tell me you rescued some princess from a tower.
Oh, Sam said. That is totally grody. Jesus!
Did I just say grody?
I told you. Even at this range, fey magic is, like, totally pernicious and infective. You need to keep careful watch on that sort of thing in this job.
So you play the violin?
Got a problem with that, pinniped boy?
Nah, Sam said. I play the banjo, sinker boy.
Sinker boy? I've never heard that one.
One of our missions is to recover Marines killed in amphibious operations. Was. Whatever. SEAL mission. Amphib sinks, Marines are weighed down with all their gear. You know, sinkers. Great spots for a little spearfishing, I might add. Fish just flock to a good jarhead sinker.
That is so sick it might even be true, I said.
Don't get me started on newbie pilots in Pecola.
I-49 sort of peters out in Texarkana, where we stayed overnight in a fleabag motel. We had to unload Honey Bear's trunk, because I wasn't going to leave all the dangerous shit in the parking lot to get stolen.
You carry laws? Sam said.
That an issue?
No, I love them.
Stick those in the golf bag with the guns. I'd rather people not see them around here. There might be talk.
You think?
Then he got towards the bottom.
That case is mil-spec, and it's still sealed. Why is it painted brown?
So people won't notice what it says is inside, I said, pulling out another couple of ammo cans. You gonna tote or ask questions?
What would it say is inside? Sam asked, as he carried the case toward the room. If it wasn't badly spray-painted brown, that is, because from the size, weight, and shape, it's a case of claymores.
Okay, I said, putting my hands on my hips.
Are you accusing me of being stupid enough to carry claymores in my trunk?
That's what I thought, Sam said, grinning ear to ear. We gonna get to use them?
Depends on what we find when we get to the end of the rainbow. I only brought 10 of them. We took I-30 out of Texarkana the next day, and shortly afterwards found ourselves on, God help me, U.S. 82, the Northeast Texas Trail, as it proudly proclaimed. 2-lane blacktop and fuck all. And I do mean fuck all. There were trees and some houses and stuff at least. But it was just... holy crap. Fuck all. Fortunately, Sam had a lot of stories. So did I. And while he had a sorely awful taste in music... Conway Twitty? Seriously? It was my car and I was driving and he didn't actually hate hard rock and what metal we could find, so we got along that way. Because if it had been the other way around, he'd have lost his head to Mono Ken. He hadn't really asked about the sword, but when I'd been working on it, I could tell he was looking at it sort of like, who is this fucker with his samurai bullshit? He had a Car 15, a Sig P220, and a big-ass Bowie knife on his belt to complement the general cowboy attitude and attire. We stopped at a roadhouse for lunch, and he fit right in. Me? Not so much. I was wearing a tailored MHI polo shirt and khakis. What? I like to look good. Sue me. We stayed on 82 for a few hours, then started to get more of a movement north from the pendant. So we turned north toward Denison on 69. Up through Durant, Oklahoma, then west again to Medill through more fuck-all and 2-lane roads. Fortunately, there was light traffic, and anything moving slow I could pass with Honey Bear, my 1976 Cutlass Supreme. I was totally ignoring the double nickel. If I got stopped, I had half a dozen get-out-of-jail-free cards to call in. We did get stopped once, just short of the Oklahoma border, by a Texas Ranger. I was blowing along a back road, doing somewhere around 120. He came around a corner in the other direction, slowed, turned on the blue lights, and turned around. I just slowed down and pulled over when I saw him slowing. He was like some sort of a stereotype. 6'9,000. Blonde from what I could see as he got out of his car. He did the get-out real slow unfolding thing. Set his hat on his head and walked up real slow, pulling out his ticket book. "You gentlemen in a hurry to get somewhere?" he asked politely. I knew the Rangers handled a good bit of their own hoodoo, so I just handed over an MHI card. "What's the incident?" All of a sudden the Ranger was real serious-like. "We're tracking a group of kidnappers." I gestured at the pendant, which was clearly not plumb. "Looks like they've headed into Oklahoma. Use of supernatural entities, necromancy, kidnapping for use in the supernatural, and, oh yeah, serial first-degree murder." "Keep it between the lines." He handed me back the card. "I'll call a couple of buddies up Durant way in case you get stopped up there." "Thank you, Ranger. Keep it. You never know when you're gonna need it." "Will do." He tucked it into a pocket. I sped off and was over 80 before he was out of sight.
"I thought all this stuff was OPSEC," Sam said.
"Some groups are read in, others aren't. You'll learn who is and who isn't wherever you're working. Rangers are all read in before they hit the road their first day. They've got such large patrol areas, they have to be fully in the know. And generally, they take care of most of Texas hoodoo. Or as they like to put it, one ranger, one revenant."
"I thought it was one ranger, one riot."
"Yeah, sure," I chuckled. "And Sam Houston never killed any vampires." It was late night as we rolled through a tiny little unnamed hamlet near Medill, Oklahoma. The pendant's swings had become more pronounced every time we made a turn. It was clear we were getting close. It currently pointed straight ahead and well off plumb. This fits the target type. I stopped Honey Bear on a deserted side road, out of the area, Bible Belt, sort of place you might actually find some virgins. The only reason I can think they'd be out in an area like this is to make a raid. A house somewhere nearby is gonna burn tonight unless we stop it.
Frago?